tell you about my boobs.
A teenage guy with a baby inside.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis, coming at you live tonight. Tonight's guest is Kinaz Finn, a show entitled Voodoo Hoodoo. We have Mr. Weddle. Are you with us, Mr. Weddle?
I am here.
We have him back. He survived Irene.
Barely.
And so did Kinaz.
I did.
Yeah. Well, let's get straight to our guest. First off, Kinaz, am I saying your name correctly? Kinaz Filin. I'm from Georgia, so...
Usually Kinaz Filin. I spent some time, and it's fine, I spent time in Georgia. Some people left their heart in San Francisco. I left a big, huge chunk of my liver in Athens, Georgia.
Hey, I used to party in Athens, Georgia, so I know that scene.
Oh, yeah. The Georgia Bar, the Roadhouse, the Globe. So many dollars and brain cells spent there.
I got a quick question for you, Kinaz.
Yep.
You've immersed yourself in, the South, New Orleans, and all the different aspects of voodoo and everything. What the hell are you doing in Jersey?
What? My wife is from New Jersey. We're currently taking care of my mother-in-law. I have lived in New York for about 15 years. You know, some people say it's the greatest city in the world. Some will disagree, but it's where I've been in the New York, New Jersey area. You know, I love the South, but it's just, I've always found New York is really my town.
I'm sitting in Philly right now.
I love Philly, too. I've had some great times in Philly, good times. But no, it's the South of the Mason-Dixon line. The culture of, New Orleans, we all know that's the northernmost Caribbean city of the Caribbean cities. But I mean, the South in general, the southern United States is a different culture than the northern United States. You know, I mean, a person in Toronto has more in common with a person in New York. A person in northern Canada has more in common with your average person in New York than they do with your average person from the South, whatever that is. I mean, they really, I can see how the Civil War happened. They are two separate countries.
Yeah, you know, I lived in the West all my life, out in Arizona and Idaho for a little bit. And I moved
to take it for granted after a while.
So, Kinaz, how exactly did you get introduced to the belief system of voodoo? How did that take place?
Well, it started one day, back in about 94, looking back was a profound spiritual experience. At the time, it felt pretty much like a schizophrenic breakdown. And so when one day, while I am living on the streets of New York, like making a part-time living, reading tarot cards and, you know, basically sleeping in alleyways, I encounter a spirit, more precisely a voice in my head, who starts telling me I am Legba, the crossroads keeper of Haitian voodoo. This is 1994, so, you know, of course, I'm sort of like, well, why do I have a voice coming in my head calling itself Legba? And I got to the point where there are two possible answers to this conundrum. The first one, which is the logical one, is that I am floridly mentally ill. My brain has begun melting down, and I am on a downward spiral, which is probably going to end with either my suicide, my incarceration, or with a lifetime of disability checks. The other part is that maybe this voice in my head is real, and I should follow it to see where it goes. Number two just seemed like it had more potential than number one. I mean, if I went with number one, it's pretty much over. If I go with number two, maybe I'm crazy, but well, hell, I'm crazy anyway, so I got nothing to lose. And so I started following what the voice was saying to me. I started treating the voice like it was, and like he was an independent spirit. He tells me, well, someday you're going to get initiated in voodoo, and, you're going to learn a lot about voodoo. This is 1994. At this time, there were a few non-Haitians doing voodoo, but it was very, very few. Voodoo in the United States was pretty much a Haitian, a for Haitians by Haitians thing. There really was not a lot going on. The Lukumi and Santeria communities, you were starting to see people get interested in that. Haitian voodoo was still, there was not a lot really of entry points in there. So I assumed, okay, like, but you're telling me all this. There's absolutely no way this is going to happen, but I might as well shake my head and nod. Now, fast forward 5 years later to 1999. At this till breakdown is over, I've got a girlfriend, I've got a full-time job, I am living in New York. And the voice shows back up, and Legba says, well, it's time for you to travel to Haiti. And I say to Legba, well, Legba, that's a great idea, but I can't go to Haiti right now. I have a job, and I have a girlfriend. I go into work the next day and discover that my boss, who had, to be fair, been ill for some time, was no longer ill. He was now dead. Since this was a law firm and he was the sole practitioner, that meant that I was no longer encumbered by a job. Now, I get back home.
I thought you were going to say you caught him screwing your girlfriend.
Oh, no, no. Well, I didn't. My girlfriend was not screwing my boss. She was screwing one of her coworkers.
No.
And when I got home, she explained to me that she was moving in with him. This literally, I am not lying to you, this was 24 hours. At which point I figured, okay, I told you I couldn't go because I have a job and a girlfriend. I no longer have a job and a girlfriend. I made plans to go to Haiti. I visited Haiti. Ed Alave Tet was, basically learned a lot about the culture, encountered voodoo face-to-face for the first time, saw actual possessions for the first time, and it was just like, I remember that spring sound as my reality tunnel just absolutely snapped, and I was just like, okay, I don't know what's going on here, but this is way beyond my understanding, and this is way beyond any typical explanation I can put on it. Yeah, this person is in a trance. This person is holding on to a burning log. He's eating embers. He's swallowing them. Embers are bouncing off his chin and down on his chest as he's doing it. This man's face is not a mass of blisters. He's not even feeling it. I'm seeing stuff like this, and I'm like, okay, there's something more going on here than I understand. I mean, there's even more than I understand with the classic kind of ceremonial magician, neo-pagan, okay, there's a weird supernatural stuff out there. This is kind of like, remember the scene in Poltergeist where the guy says, I was at this enormous, I saw this enormous thing, like last week I saw a car move 6 inches over the course of a night, and then he opens the door, and there's like all the chaos going on. That was pretty much where my reality tunnel was at that point in 1999. Returned home, 2003, I was initiated in Haitian voodoo by Mambo Edelin Son Amand at Société La Belle Venus, number 2 in Brooklyn, New York. Our number 1 office is in Jacmel, Haiti. 2006, I wrote the Haitian Voodoo Handbook. Then I wrote Voodoo Love Magic, Voodoo Money Magic. Wrote a book on transpossession called Drawing Down the Spirits with Raven Caldera. Wrote a book on poppies and painkillers as shamanic allies in March of 2011. Then I wrote the New Orleans Voodoo Handbook, which brings us up to the present time.
Hey,
and
When you initially went down to New Orleans, to start, you know, getting into voodoo and everything, did you experience any pushback from people, you know, people not, being accepting of you?
Most of my actual experience with voodoo was within the Haitian community in New York. By and large, the Haitians that I've met in New York more or less what you'll get is not hostility so much as like, you know, why are you interested in this? You know, this is like kind of a Haitian thing. We're kind of wondering, you know, why would a blonde, you know, which blonde literally means white. It actually means what it means in Creole is foreigner. I mean, a black American is a blonde. They're like, well, why are the blondes interested in this? But, you know, but it's cool. You know, it's cool with us. If they're serious about it, they'll treat you serious. You know, if you behave like a goof, they'll treat you like a goof. There's not that much. Within New Orleans, the one thing I have noticed about the New Orleans voodoo scene is it can be really, there's a lot of competition, and there can be a lot of cutthroat, I'm getting the sense one of the favorite things in New Orleans is like that. I don't like to say anything bad about people, but, so it's like, I think there's a lot of competition within that community, but I have not really run into that so far, because I'm not really trying to make a lot of money off the community. I'm not making a living there. I am more interested in, like, what is this enormously interesting tradition that took place in the, grew up on the shores of the United States? I wanted to find out how much it had in common with Haitian voodoo. The answer I found was a lot more than people think and a lot less than people think. Then, you know, and the more I discovered it, I started studying the city of New Orleans itself, and that's an adventure right there. I mean, that was probably out of every book I've ever written, the New Orleans voodoo book was the most fun I ever had. I mean, you really would have to work overtime to make the history of New Orleans boring.
Right.
But
yeah, the book is excellent. It's definitely, I've been looking through it, and it's definitely on my reading completely list. I'm going to read it all and take it in. It's excellent. There's photographs of, you know, places in New Orleans that are, you know, historical. It's just, it's great. It's a really, really good put together, and it has the prayers. One thing I wanted to try to understand is, I don't know a lot about voodoo, so basically this is me being schooled, interviewing you on voodoo and what I've seen from your book, and of course you have all the Hollywood mumbo jump, like Serpent in the Rainbow. That's about the extent of my voodoo knowledge. The one thing I'm trying to understand, how exactly did Christian saints and icons get so mixed up in the voodoo? What's the history behind that? When I saw the Christian references in the book, I was like, what? It kind of threw me for a loop because I just didn't understand. If you could, how does that get intermingled into it?
Oh, that's a huge story. Now, one thing that people don't really understand is how much, like, there's a real idea that, like, the slaves, you know, the Africans were never exposed to Christianity before they got to the New World. That what they were, and that's not, like, they may not have been observant Christians, but there were one of the first kingdoms, I think Armenia was the first kingdom to actually declare itself a Christian kingdom. The first Christian Empire before the Roman Empire was Aksum, which is an African kingdom on the shores of Ethiopia. The Ethiopians were Christians from a very early time period. There were Christian traders going through that region for centuries. As early as the 15th century, the king of Dom Pedro converted to Christianity. So there was already a lot of Christian influence within those cultures. I mean, these people were already familiar with Christians and with Catholic missionaries. When they got here, keep in mind, these are not religions where there is one true way of going with it. They're generally syncretic. I mean, these religions, they will pick up, you know, if they saw another practice happening and like, oh, that, you know, that looks interesting, it fits our needs, you know, that spirit answers that person's prayers, they'll start honoring that spirit.
Gotcha. Yeah, and it's like, for instance, Archangel Michael, his name's Mr. Daniel Blanc.
Daniel Blanc. Danny Blanc. Yeah, Monsieur Blanc Danny, which is a really, that was an interesting one. It's like, you'd see Daniel Blanc, the Archangel Michael, and you'd find that praise name in Haitian voodoo. That's one of the names, Blanc Danny, you know, Great Dan, or Grand Danny. You'll hear both of those in a Haitian ceremony. So I was like, wow, so Damballa, you know, never got a lot of major attention in Haiti the way, I mean, New Orleans, say, the way he got in Haiti. But yeah, he showed up there. You know, Agassou showed up there as Yan Su, which was really fascinating for me. You know, Iron Joe Farai, Iron Joe, who you see as Ogu. You saw where, okay, some of this stuff obviously came from the same source as Haiti. Some of it came maybe from Dominicans, you know, slaves leaving Saint-Domingue, so many as people think. But, you know, there were a fair number of the Loa who made it through with the early crossing. Then in the 1970s, with Charles Bazicap Gandolfo and the Voodoo, New Orleans Voodoo Museum, he kind of, a lot of purists will spit on the ground when they hear Charlie Gandolfo's name because it's like, you know, he made it for the tourists. You know, he threw this whole mishmash together. It was all kind of one part Santeria, one part Haitian voodoo, one part whatever you could read in Fate magazine, and he tossed it all together and he made it for the tourists, and it's all fake and it's all phony. There's some truth to that, but despite that, that tradition that he created became this just enormously important spiritual practice for many people living in New Orleans. I mean, you've got people like Sally Ann Glassman, you've got people like Mambo Miriam Shamani, people are coming to New Orleans making spiritual pilgrimages. People are coming there and they are having spiritual experiences. Yeah, I don't know whether it started, I don't know what Charles Massacat Gandolfo's entire motivations were. You know, I will admit he was like, a lot of times as a historian, he was a great storyteller. He exaggerated some stuff, but he created something. He started a trend that has just grown and grown and grown. And it's like, I might also add, okay, he created this, like, we have New Orleans as a spirituality that was created for tourists to make money. I'm like, by God, then it's the most authentic American spirituality I could imagine.
There you go. Hey, is voodoo mainly in its true form, I guess, a Caribbean religion, or?
Voodoo, it depends on you'll see a spelling, V-O-D-O-U-N. It's pronounced Vadon. It's like, it's got a nasalized French N. And that is typically used to describe the practices in Benin, in Togo, in the Daomé region of Western Africa. That has some similarities. Then you have V-O-D-O-U, which is the spelling which is typically used for the practices in Haiti. Then you have Vodou, V-O-D-U, Dominicano, and V-O-D-U, Cubano. That is Dominican voodoo and Cuban voodoo. Those are voodoo practices. In both cases, they started with Haitian immigrants to the Dominican Republic and to Cuba. But they have added some other stuff of their own in there, like some Lucumi and Santeria influences. You then have V-O-O-D-O-O, and that is the spelling which is typically used for New Orleans voodoo. It's also the spelling that's used for what I call Hollywood voodoo, which you mentioned, Serpent of the Rainbow. That kind of thing. I walked with a zombie, you know, white zombie, that kind of, like, those cannibal cousins, that whole school of voodoo. So it's like, there's a whole bunch of things that go under that rubric voodoo. New Orleans voodoo is also influenced by H-O-O-D-O-O, hoodoo, which is an African-American folk tradition that incorporates a lot of psalm magic and also has a strong Congo influence.
Like the title of the show, Voodoo Zoodoo. Even though I didn't know exactly what voodoo was, I thought it sounded good for a title.
Yeah. Well, voodoo, New Orleans voodoo. Voodoo is very largely influenced by, you know, by African-American hoodoo. The main difference between, say, the hoodoo you might see in Alabama, the hoodoo that you might see, you know, in North Carolina, South Carolina, the New Orleans voodoo because there was a much stronger Roman Catholic presence there. Tends to have more of a Catholic slant. You'll see more Catholic saints and Catholic prayers, where the voodoo, the hoodoo that you see among African Americans tends largely to be more Protestant-based, you know, the Psalms from the King James Bible, that sort of thing. And that, incidentally, is one of the big things that actually came from Saint Domingue. The Dominican refugees that settled New Orleans really cemented the Catholic Church there. I mean, it's not like, don't get the idea that like people in New Orleans are particularly devout Catholics, but they're Catholic. And that makes the city stand out a good bit from, say, the rest of the southern United States, where, I mean, Catholics are kind of looked askance on. And that's so, like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so since there's such a Catholic slant, I'm assuming that voodoo is, you know, essentially white magic.
Ah, okay. The terms white magic and black magic, you don't really see them used within Caribbean traditions. The terms you'll see, like, the thing about white magic or black magic is like, well, what's white magic? You know, okay, this guy is like, you know, this guy is really harassing, like, you know, my sister. He's really, you know, he works for her. You know, he's her boss, and he's really, like, harassing her, and he won't leave her alone, you know, and it's like she really has no recourse. I go burn a candle, and the guy comes down with a bad case of death. Well, you know, he's no longer harassing my sister. Therefore, from the viewpoint of my sister, that's white magic.
Right.
You know, white magic basically is like, you know, it's kind of like, well, you did a healing spell. It's like, yeah, well, you just committed genocide against billions of germs.
There you go.
It's like white magic, black magic. It's kind of like, you know, does the magic work for me or does the magic work for someone else? You know, I mean, it's like if it works in my favor, it's generally within a voodoo tradition, you know, that's white magic. If it does what it, like, if it makes things better for me, it's white magic. I'm less concerned with, in practice, you really don't do a lot of the stuff like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm going to call this blood, I'm going to call up Linglesu Bucket of Blood, Linglesu Basin Song. When this guy shows up, seeing him come in possession, he will pick up a bottle, he will bite the bottle, bite the neck off the bottle, and chew and swallow the glass. I'm going to call him to really mess with my, like, mess with this guy I don't like. Well, that's good. I called up Linglesu. Linglesu messed with this guy I don't like. Now I've got Linglesu hanging around my house, and he's hungry. Well, I better send him after another enemy. Oh, you don't have any enemies. Well, that's fine. You got friends. That's, you know, I mean, you basically, if you, you know, it is, the potential is there for you to work with the most, you know, really, with, you know, a really hot job, they'll say, you know, a really active, really aggressive spirit that will happily, you know, disembowel anybody you point it towards. But that so, means you're working with a hot spirit that'll disembowel anybody you point it towards, and if you don't, and if it gets mad at you, it'll disembowel you.
So, who is the devil in New Orleans voodoo? What is his name? Like, Michael has his name. What would the devil be called?
Well, you've got an old man at the crossroads who's sometimes identified as, like, with the devil. The devil, like, you don't really have a, you, in Haitian voodoo, you'll have Le Roi Le Sif in some societies, King Lucifer. And some people will, like, you, what the basic principle there is, you're not worshiping Satan, you're like, hey, look, he's Satan. You give him props and hope he'll go away. What you'll have is the devil, as you have it in New Orleans voodoo, is more a figure who'll go to the crossroads and he'll teach you to throw dice, he'll teach you to play guitar, he'll teach you skills involving manual dexterity. But he's not particularly evil. He also is very similar to a figure you'll see a lot in Brazil. He looks kind of like a devil, and he can be kind of mischievous, but he's found frequently at crossroads, and he'll teach you. You'll see Exus, E-X-U it's spelled, who are, like, you'll see them all over Brazil. He's more similar to that. As far as a satanic figure, you know, somebody who fits the role of the devil, like the role the devil plays in the Christian church, don't really have that in New Orleans voodoo. If you do, they'll just call it the devil, and you'll try to run the devil out. There's basically what you'll do is, you know, you'll get holy water, you'll try to, like, you'll get, like, there are negative spirits you'll get out, but, you know, somebody like a big Satan character, like just a god of evil who exists, who's, like, you know, kind of like Christopher Lee, what's my motivation? I'm evil, I'm here to do evil. Like, why? Because I'm evil. Next question, you know. No, not really anybody like that.
So it's like a trickster, like Coyote or something, like a trick.
Yeah, that would be closer to what you have there. Absolutely.
Okay, another one, another being that I find fascinating that I've been reading about in your book is, we were talking about the zombie situation. Who is Grand Zombie?
Le Grand Zombie was, supposedly, that was the name, like, that Marie Laveau reported to her snake. The Great Zombie, who she used to dance with when she was going, when she was doing voodoo rituals. That probably comes from the word Nsambi in Congo. It's interesting to note that Marie Laveau, the woman she trained from, referred to herself in court records, like the woman who led the ceremonies before her was a woman named Betsy Tolinado. There was a ceremony was broken up by police and something was confiscated. I seem to recall it was a statue. Betsy Tolinado referred to herself in court rules as a queen of the Congo, which again just goes to show Congo is where most of the spiritual stuff in the United States comes from. The vast majority of Africans who were imported to the United States came from the Congo regions. And in the Congo, snakes are seen as they travel between the realms of earth. Like, you can find snakes in the tree, you can find snakes in water, you can find snakes underground, you can find them on the ground. So snakes are seen as just between the realms. And Nzambi, the Grand Nzambi, would be the great god, or the great spirit. So that's, like, that's where Nzambi comes into, like, New Orleans voodoo.
In the past, I've had some experiences when I was messing with the occult in my younger days where I saw some beings that were very serpent-like. Are there serpent-type beings in voodoo?
Absolutely. Snakes are extremely important in voodoo. There's, like, the Thimbis frequently will come as snakes. Dambala just comes as a massive white snake. You know, the Grand Zombie, Nsambi, who you see in New Orleans voodoo. Yeah, snakes are extremely important in voodoo. Snakes are also important in a lot of other spiritual traditions. I mean, because the snake sheds its skin, it's seen as immortal in a lot of traditions. They get a bad rap in ours because, unfortunately, the main reference we have to snakes within our religion, within, you know, the Christian religious tradition, is, of course, the snake who tempts Eve in the Garden of Eden.
In my past, I saw some beings that were like serpents, and I tell you, never ever forget them, that's for sure. And when I saw the serpent and Grand Zombie and stuff, it kind of like gave me a little chill, a little bit.
Oh, yeah, no, they are, like, I find that one of the things you'll notice with voodoo, that whole family of spirits is that they're not afraid to scare the bejesus out of you. And in fact, frequently will do so to get your attention.
Yeah, they probably think it's funny.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like, I think that's something that has attracted a lot of people who've come in from, like, say, some of the more Western or some of the more sedate magical traditions is, you know, you could... The old saying you hear in voodoo is like, yeah, well, you can go to, like, you go to church and talk to God, you know, and then, but we, then we go to a voodoo ceremony and God comes down and talks to us. And it's like, you know, it's such a direct, you know, so, they're so in your face. They're so, you know, there's, like I keep saying, there's no faith involved. I think it's like, remember, I believe it was Aleister Crowley who said once, you know, there is nothing better to convince, there's nothing which convinces you of the existence of the spirit world so much as having, like, you know, a box of tissues bounced off your head.
Yep, or thrown on the ground. Or
yeah, it's like kind of like they will do stuff that is just so spectacular that it's like, you know, okay, you want to get my attention. And as my friend Ungan Abuja has said, one of the reasons they do that is so they know, like, that's the bill. I did this. Now give me a gift for it.
Now, so what types of gifts?
Can be a lot of things. A lot of times you can burn a candle for a spirit. That's a lot of times you give them light, you give them prayers. You'll find a lot of water. You can give water to the spirits. Cool water is a really good offering for the deceased, for the dead. You know, the white table, which is you have the water, you have a cross or whatever, like whatever thing from your ancestral tradition is there, and you add some water. You can use rum or high octane or alcohol to heat them, you know, to make the spirits more active. You can give them food. You can give animal sacrifices. Let me just say to everybody listening right now, do not try a DIY animal sacrifice at home. You know, if you got a spirit that's been bothering you, telling you, you know, you need to give me an animal sacrifice, whatever, go talk to somebody in an ATR who's a professional who knows how to do it safely and humanely and have it done. We don't really, you know, killing your neighbor's cat because you want to bring up Beelzebub has nothing to do with voodoo. It has nothing to do with, like, any kind of actual Satanism. It has nothing to do with any kind of occult. It's like, that's stupid, sick, antisocial behavior. But, you know, as far as what you can give spirits, just about anything. The main thing that I think is important to remember when you're working within, like, this voodoo, within a lot of these spiritual traditions is, you know, but there ain't no thing as a free lunch. When you get something from a spirit, you give something to the spirit in return. That is just that is expected. You know, if you don't do that, you know, there's a feeling, you know, I cringe when I see the New Age stuff. You know, the universe is a place of abundance. Just ask and you will be given everything. It's like, you know, well, you know, when I see a car, do I just ask for it and it's given to me? No, I have to go buy it. And it's like, you know, when my boss wants something done, do they just ask me to do it? Well, yes, they do. And at the end of the week, they give me a check for doing it. And the spirit will, as above, so below. If you wouldn't just walk up, like, you know, devote a whole bunch of your time to some total stranger's problems with no, you know, for no expectation of recompense, why on earth would the spirit world do that?
Yeah.
Right.
So, Marie Laveau, I think I just messed up her name, and Dr. John, how did they contribute to birthing New Orleans voodoo?
Marie Laveau, well, Dr. John is an absolutely big character. He, from what we know about him, he appears to have been a Senegalese, like he appears to have come from Senegal, was a very charismatic fellow, and had apparently a lot of, yeah, just very charismatic, and had a large clientele. Louis Martigny has said a lot of stuff that he is apparently, like, Louis Martigny has done a lot of research on New Orleans voodoo in his systems, like, he associates Dr. John with drumming. I haven't seen a lot of stuff that's, like, you know, which specifically was contemporaneous that said Dr. John was a drummer, but I have not looked at, like, you know, all of the records, and I'm sure Martigny may have seen some stuff I did not. What I do know about Dr. John was he was just had an enormous empire, was wealthy enough and powerful enough that in the 1830s, you know, among his wives, he had, like, at least one white woman. That, you know, I mean, New Orleans was pretty tolerant of race mixing by and large, but when you were, like, a male who was very black and had, like, African facials, you were, like, you know, sleeping with white women, and you weren't getting lynched, that was an accomplishment, even in New Orleans in the 1820s. You know, he lost a lot of his money because he didn't really know how to read and write, and people accused him of, like, he got ripped off a lot more than he ever ripped anybody off. I mean, one thing he said once was, you know, I never did anything to hurt anybody, but if somebody is going to give me $50 for, like, you know, to make magic for him, I'll take that $50 every time. Unfortunately, he also had a habit of, like, somebody, I remember one story, somebody taught him how to sign his name, and he was very proud of that, and he signed his name to, and the guy had him sign his name on a deed, which deeded over a large chunk of his land to this person. Stuff like that. So, Marie Laveau was a woman of color who, was, that was actually the term. I mean, she was born to a free black man and his wife in about early part 1801, I want to say. I'd have to look at the book again to get the exact date. Married a man named Christophe Glapion, had a number of kids. Mr. Glapion died, leaving her, you know, essentially, in, like, leaving her with a lot of debts and very little money. So she needed to do something to support, and what she appears to have done was taken up, you know, spell work, as like voodoo. She became a very popular voodoo mambo at the time, or as they called her, a voodoo queen. And, again, had a multiracial clientele, which was something that at that time was not, you know, again, was not common in New Orleans, but was, you know, you saw it happening in New Orleans. You really weren't seeing it as much. New Orleans was less segregated than most of the southern United States. That doesn't mean it wasn't. That doesn't mean there was no racism, but less so. But Laveau became a really famous figure as, like, was probably the most famous of the voodoo queens of New Orleans. A journalist named Robert Talent, who was, I don't know if I'd say journalist, really was kind of a man about town looking for a job, and wrote a book about Marie Laveau, voodoo queen of New Orleans. It was a fiction book. Did a fair bit of research, but it was like, you know, when the research didn't work, made up some stories. That, you'll find, is basically the story of New Orleans research, is trying to separate the fiction. But, and that book became very popular, as did his other book, Voodoo in New Orleans. And so, you know, the Marie Laveau cult began. Today, you know, Marie Laveau is seen as a feminist icon. She's been seen, you know, Queen of the Witches. She's become just this enormously important figure, and, you know, has become a symbol of New Orleans voodoo.
Very interesting indeed. Are we at break yet, guy? Can you see the chat room? I closed it.
No, we got about 5 minutes.
Okay. What's that?
I'm just saying we got like 5 minutes.
Oh, okay. We got about 5 minutes, then we're going to take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and finish up. Kinaz, what is your website? We'll go ahead and give the audience the link. Do you have a website?
Website. I've got a blog. My website is pretty easy to remember. It's www.kenazfilan.com. And the blog is kenazfilan.blogspot.com.
Nice. So a lot of, like, for instance, let's say I needed more money, or Bailey, I need pot. What's a spell that would work to bring that to me on some level? Maybe a candle-type spell, or?
Let's say you need more money. Well, there's a lot of things you could do there. I would say, let's say, what happened that you, like, why is it you're needing money? Well, first, I'm trying to think of, like, there's so many different ways you could go about that one. I had some stuff about Asanker, who's the bringer of good fortune. He's a spirit you don't hear. There's very little written about him. A lot of the Haitian Loa did not make it to New Orleans until, like, the 1970s. Asanker, also known as Anzanker, is extremely interesting in that Anzanker appears to be an African spirit who made it to New Orleans, but not Haiti. Or, so far as we can tell, nowhere else. Asanker is found in New Orleans. He's, like, basically the spirit of prosperity and good fortune. You know, I've had somebody say spirit of propinquity, what was the word she used? But it was basically the spirit of putting you in the right place at the right time.
And I like it.
Find a green bayberry candle. Find a green bayberry candle. Get some rum for him, and I ask him to help you out. And like, I think I got a prayer there in the book. And let me know how it goes.
What's his name again in the book, where I can find the prayer?
Assonquer.
Okay. I'll have to check that one out for sure. No doubt about it.
Do they have one for when your hair falls out?
Oh, if I did, I'd be praying to them. Yeah, my bald spot's been racing my hairline since I was 16. I just shaved it because I figured, you know, look, I can grow three of them and I wrap them around my head and pretend nobody will notice. So I can just say, you know, the hell with it, I'm bald.
There you go.
I'm in the same boat, I promise you.
Yeah, at least our generation was smart enough, we don't do the comb over anymore.
Yeah, we don't wear those monk cuts, we just shave it off.
Grow a goatee or something.
Alrighty.
So Jeff, is that why you're getting all them chickens now, so you can start doing some voodoo ceremonies and...
No, we're getting the chickens. We got chickens today. It's for eggs, strictly for eggs.
Uh-huh.
Pretty cool, though. We have little baby chickens. They're kind of cute.
All right, man, we got about a minute. I guess we'll just go to break, and we'll come back in about 10 minutes, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, it's having a great time here so far. Looking forward to part two.
All right, man.
All right. Yeah. Definitely enjoy.
George.
And I'm Stephanie Benetti. Psychic medium, are you sure about that, Chris? It's more like psychic extra large.
Yeah, real funny, Benetti. Depending on being my girlfriend, you would know. Together, we are Second Sight NYC, a parapsychic radio show based out of New York City.
Join us each week as we journey into the unknown. Let's cross the threshold of reality together.
We take a fun and no-nonsense approach to our show, and we love to interact with our audience. Each week, you can expect a great guest, interesting topics, and strong opinions by myself and Stephanie.
As well as rapid readings, psychic dream interpretations, and the gemstone of the week. And don't ask us a question that you don't want an answer to.
Give us 2 hours of your time to inform, enlighten, and entertain you. Let the journey begin.
Join us.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
The Church of Mabus radio show is now in session, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern, with high strange scholars teaching us of ufology, the paranormal, the occult, and the metaphysical. Seek sanctuary with the Dark Reverends, Jeffrey Pritchard and Guy Widell, at www.mabusincarnate.com, always moshing with the apocalypse. Now get down on your knees and pray!
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Taldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Living easy.
To the Church of Mavis, our show entitled Voodoo Voodoo with Kenaz Fillon. I guess basically to start off, I want to kind of get into the Hollywood stereotype of some things like we see in movies that are usually the first things people think about when they think of voodoo, as far as from a Hollywood, which I'm not going to say that, you know, Hollywood loves to mess up all kinds of stuff, but two topics that I want to talk about and just get your take on it. First off, the goofy topic of zombies. And then also voodoo dolls. So, for instance, in your experience, is there, you've been to Haiti, is there any truth at all to a voodoo doctor using the puffer fish, so to speak, to control another human being as a zombie?
Okay, as far as it goes, I have not spoken with Wade Davis, who wrote Serpent in the Rainbow. Incidentally, Serpent in the Rainbow, pretty good book about Haitian voodoo. Execrable movie. Wes Craven should be ashamed of himself. But that's like neither here nor there. The person I have spoken to on several occasions is Dr. Max Beauvoir, who's a pretty well-known Haitian Hungan, who is also a PhD in chemistry, who assisted Dr. Davis in determining what water was that was being used in zombification rituals. I have never encountered personally anybody who had been zombified. The evidence is overwhelming that it has happened in the past. It's not particularly common. I've seen the term zombie used among other things. Like, you'll see people not necessarily like voodoo, Sefas Gina, the Orthodox voodoo, some of the secret societies, I've seen what's called zombie bottles. They'll have stuff tied around them. And the idea is you put a dead spirit and then a zombie in that bottle and you tie it to, like, the way you tie your shoe. It gives the spirit a body, and then you can, like, talk to the spirit and do things, like, and have the spirit do things for you. I know my initiatory father had a couple of zombie bottles in his basement. One of them he had wrapped with a chain, which was chained to his wall. I asked him why. He said it was because the spirit in it was walking around the house making noise and disturbing his children, so he had to chain it up. That I've seen, you know, my wife was holding one of the bottles, and I remember her saying she felt like it had crawled. He goes, oh yeah, well, that one's a baby. So I've seen zombie bottles. I've seen a lot of zombie bottles. They're fairly common. The actual zombie itself, like the person who was zombified, not so much. The thing I find really fascinating about the whole zombie mythology is how much today people are describing Haitian zombies, where it's like, that myth did not come from Haiti, sir. It came from a man named George Romero, a Pittsburgh film director, who wrote a few really brilliant films, which have now become like a set of standard for zombies, which has like absolutely nothing to do with the Haitian thing, but which is pretty cool in and of itself. Voodoo dolls are like, you know, I have not, within Haitian voodoo, if you see a doll, within most forms of voodoo, Haitian voodoo, New Orleans voodoo, if you see a doll, chances are that doll is a home for a spirit. That doll has been baptized, you know, that doll will be an ally. The idea of sticking in dolls is more commonly found within Western witchcraft. It's specifically, you know, Mary Queen, in the case of one of the lovers of Mary Queen of Scots, I believe, was executed because he was involved in a ceremony that involved making a wax figurine, naming it King James, sticking pins in it, and then melting it. Which, you know, of course, how that idea originally got popularized is, from 1915 to 1934, the United States Marines occupied Haiti. At that time, you started getting some accounts back, like titled like White Queen, King of Gonaive, you know, Cannibal Cousins with the title of one, I Walked with a Zombie. And then you'd have with the movies, you know, well, what do witch doctors do? You know, and of course these guys had, you know, they'd never been to Haiti. They wouldn't know a witch doctor if they stumbled over him. Well, okay, what do witches do? Well, witches stick pins in dolls to make them, like, well, cool, that's what witch doctors do too. And then somewhere from there, we got the idea that, you know, voodoo involves a lot of sticking pins in dolls. I have never seen a voodoo ceremony that involves sticking pins in dolls. I've heard of it being done in New Orleans voodoo, but there's other things you would tend to do that would be a lot more effective. So that's gotcha. Another one of those brilliant cases wherein, like, you know, it's one of those really brilliant situations where you see, like, where movies just totally changed our perception of this, like, you know, in this cracked out way for, like, you know, it's just that I find really fascinating. You know, when you get to, like, movie voodoo, it's like, okay, well, between George Romero and, like, the 30s stuff, you know, you got people sticking pins in dolls and you got these flesh-eating, like, you know, monsters from beyond the grave, which neither of which really have much to do with voodoo in Haiti or in New Orleans.
Yeah, but you also had the old Haitian president that was using that as a fear tactic to control people.
Papa Doc Chevalier was absolutely, he was part of a group called Les Noiristes. It was a black consciousness movement that started about that time. You have to understand, within Haitian culture, there's frequently been, you know, there's been a lot of tension between, you know, les nègres et les mulats, the blacks and the colored. The colored would be the les gens de couleur, the people, the lighter-skinned people would tend to really downplay the African stuff. You know, the old joke was the gens de couleur of Saint-Domingue were more French than the French. You know, it's like, well, they were like, well, we're in French. We don't, like, this African stuff, that's savage, you know, that's primitive. That's, like, you know, shameful. The Noiristes were among the first Haitian intellectuals to say, no, you know, this is a valuable part of our culture. And, you know, this is something, you know, this is an important spiritual discipline. And one of the leading figures in that was Papa Doc Duvalier, who was a, you know, by most accounts, actually kind of this shy sort of intellectual, you know, really very much beloved by the Haitian population at first. He had done a lot of work to eradicate yaws, which was this disease that, like, leaves open sores on your feet. It's a spirochete, which is very similar to, in fact, maybe identical to the spirochete which causes genital syphilis. He did a lot to eradicate yaws on the island of Haiti, became very popular with that. He then, you know, when he ascended to power in Haiti, proceeded to grow increasingly megalomaniacal, you know, thanks to a group, to his personal militia, the Tata Macoutes, you know, just took total control of Haiti. Had something where, like, we opened the day with the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, Haitian school children will pray, you know, to our Doc who art in the capital, hallowed be thy name. You know, if this sounds a lot like the Our Father, it's because it is. So Jesus with Papa Doc beside him, you know, like, you know, Jesus who rules, like, earth, and, like, you know, Papa Doc who rules on behalf of Jesus. He would also take on, you know, he tended to wear the clothing of Balansamadi, the loa, like one of the loa connected with death in the cemetery, Baron Saturday. So that was like, you know, he was connected with death. The Tata Macoute would dress like, they'd wear denim clothing like the agriculture loa Zaka, because Zaka is a peasant, Zaka is a loa of the people. You know, the message here is like, well, these are like, you know, we're from the people. We're of the people. We're protecting you from the evil Malats. The problem is the Tata Macoute became like, basically an army unto themselves. It was like, you know, we like your, you know, your business is doing well. We like your business. We took your business and we shot you. You know, we like your wife. scene. You know, it was really, like, it was just such a horrifyingly oppressive dictatorship. And, you know, Duvalier stayed in power mainly by playing off the United States versus the versus the Soviet Union. You know, it was like, as Lyndon Johnson once said of, like, you know, I believe, who was it he said of? It was like the Vietnamese president, the South Vietnamese president, you know, he may be an SOB, but he's our SOB. That was Duvalier for us. He was our SOB. You know, Duvalier made the tap-taps run on time. Killed about 30,000 Haitians, essentially ran the Haitian middle class out. Most of them came to the United States, where a lot of them will be found in Miami, and even more will be found in Brooklyn. But he, a lot of Haitians today, particularly in Brooklyn, you know, I've met quite a few in my house, look back fondly on the good of Dr. Duvalier because the crime rate was a lot lower. People were poor, and people were poor. They were not starving. Today, people are starving. You know, people today, like, kidnapping is run rampant. You didn't have to worry about kidnappers in the days of Papa Doc, because if you were kidnapping people and you weren't a Tom Macoute, they were going to find you at the crossroads the next morning. You may have been, you know, probably skinned. If you were lucky, they killed you before they skinned you.
Right.
It was like, they were very, you know, it was like, there wasn't a lot of crime during Papa Doc's day. There was a certain degree, you know, it was not anything like, you can't call it prosperity, but it wasn't as bad as it is today. That's, so it's like, you also will see the same thing in the former Soviet Union. A lot of Russians look back fondly on the good old days when Uncle Joe Stalin was in charge.
Right.
So, that's...
Well, when Haiti was, you know, they had that other military guy in there,
We've had a few real military guys there. Sid,
yeah,
they've had, like, yeah, that's basically...
Who was a guy in the 90s that we had our special forces already in the air.
Yeah, that was, like, basically, FROP. I knew some of the people that had been involved in that. Though, like, I met and actually spoke with one of the guys who had led that. He's currently in prison on different charges. But there are, like, yeah, well, Haiti has just... Haiti... I'd say it's a difficult country to rule at this point. It's probably more like an impossible country to rule. And generally, the people who have ruled Haiti have, by and large, it's been more or less ruled by kleptocracies, where the idea is, like, I want to come to power so I can make as much money as I can before I get, like, before I get thrown out of the country, and then I can move to Paris or to wherever, or to Jamaica or wherever else, and I can live in luxury for the remainder of my days.
Right.
But yes, when it comes to voodoo, is there any, like, for instance, you have shamans, not all shamans, of course, they do, like, peyote or ayahuasca. Are there any drugs that fit into the ceremonies that they do or rituals?
Interestingly, I have not found hallucinogenic or mind-altering drugs used in voodoo or in any of the African diaspora traditions. There is a church, I think it's the Church of Santo Daime. There's a few churches in Brazil which are, like, doing possession stuff, which also are taking ayahuasca. Have not really heard of it in Haiti, have not really heard of it at all in Cuba. I would not really want to go to a ritual where I might get possessed, where I might, like, have something come on me and be, like, drugged. I would think, you know, it's like, it would make me feel fuzzy. You know, I have no problem with using mind-altering substances for, like, a good purpose, but it's, like, not really within voodoo. It's really, it's something that, like, a lot of people find surprising, but no, there's really no tradition of entheogenic, of sacred plants or entheogenic stuff within voodoo, within Lukumi, within Palo Mayombe, so far as I know, within most of the African and African diaspora traditions. Yeah, but the only thing within Africa, like you see, there's the Iboga tradition, which is Ibogaine, which is a fascinating subject of its own. You know, there are people that use sacred plants, but voodoo, not so much.
Yeah, voodoo seems to be a personal, you know, a personal, I can't say religion because it's kind of a, I don't know really what to call it, but
It's a what I've heard it called is voodoo culture. It's a way of life. It's a way of seeing things. It's a way of like dealing with them. But I would say, yeah, it's a really, you said a personal thing. One of the things I've heard is, you know, voodoo can't be studied. It can only be danced.
Right.
You know, it's like you have to experience. It's something you really have to experience. And that's, you know, I mean, and that can be really frightening for some people. You know, like, I mean, myself personally, I tend to be more of a cerebral person. I tend to be something, you know, I tend to do more, like, you know, I prefer a lot of times thinking to actually doing. And it's like, voodoo can get you away from that because it's like, you really can't, you know, as you get involved in voodoo, you get involved in voodoo.
Right. It's literally a way of life.
It is a way of life.
So, yes, how do the natives fit into this, like Native Americans? Who is Black Hawk and the Black Hawk spiritual churches? Are they natives?
The Black Hawk churches of New Orleans are just, that's one of those really, really fascinating, really powerful traditions that is not really so well known. That started when a black woman named Leafy Anderson, who was from Chicago, comes to New Orleans. At this time, this is the 1920s, this is the time when a lot of blacks are moving to Chicago, moving to New York. This is the time when you start seeing the exodus from the South. Black Hawk, who is this woman named Leafy Anderson's spirit guide, this black woman in Chicago, tells her, you know, no, you're going to go down to New Orleans because I'm the Indian saint of the South and you're going to set up my church. And she comes down there. It becomes an extremely becomes a really popular church. Black Hawk is based on a historical figure seen as a guardian. You know, he's seen as, a lot of times you'll hear the Black Hawk, he's on your wall. The idea is he's the Indian on your wall. He's the Indian that watches you. He keeps you away from trouble. Frequently, what keeping away from trouble means is keeping the law away from your door. And that's something you'll see in New Orleans. One of the big ones, if you go to like an old-time like brothel in New Orleans, a lot of times you'll see that the wall, like if you look at the top of the wall, there will be Indian head pennies lining the wall, like right by the ceiling. The idea there being that all these Indian head pennies, the Indians are looking out for the Indians are looking out, making sure that the law doesn't come. And you'll see that really frequently. That's the role they play. The Indians are protectors. You also have Indians in the Mardi, you have them, what they call the Mardi Gras Indians, and that's a whole tradition in and of itself. That's the Mardi Gras, that's people will dress up in Indian costumes. They've been doing that for Mardi Gras since about the 1890s with some Wild West shows. You'll just see these amazing costumes. Matter of fact, the costumes are really amazing, and that's good because you used to have a lot of problems with the marching Indian tribes would get in fights over who was like the best dressed. Today, people might spend thousands of dollars on their costumes. The Indian costumes are pretty similar to what people spend for, if you've ever seen the Labor Day Carnival in New York City, stuff like that. You have just these enormous feathered sequins. You don't really want to get in a fight when you spent $5,000+ building your costume.
Yeah, it's like the mummers in Philly.
It's the mummers. Yeah, it's very like that. And so you have that. So, yeah, the Indians, Native Americans played a really interesting role in, you know, within New Orleans. A lot of within the Indian communities, you saw a lot of the Marrons, the runaway slaves that would go to the swamps, did a lot of work with, like, a lot of times they had, you know, help with the Indians, from the Indians who lived there. There's like, that's a whole tradition in and of itself that has not really been studied a lot. If there's somebody listening out there that really wants to do some scholarship on New Orleans voodoo, on Louisiana culture, they want something that really needs to be done, is some more study on the role of Native Americans within, like, in the role they've played within New Orleans and Louisiana culture. Like, there's a thesis out there. There's a really important book out there. You know, and I really hope somebody just has the time and, like, to dedicate themselves to it, because that's an area of scholarship that really hasn't gotten a lot of attention.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the movie Angel Heart?
I have indeed. And incidentally, the movie is pretty good. The one I really like a lot is the book is based Falling Angel, the book by William Hutzberg, which it's based on, is much better. It doesn't have
really?
Mr. Bonet naked, but that, like, we could, but it's still pretty good. But that, no, Angel Heart was a fun film. Some people didn't really, I thought it was, like, I enjoyed it, but the book is astonishing. The book, Hutzberg got a grant for it, did a tremendous amount of research, not just into New Orleans voodoo, but into the grimoires and a lot of the demonic and diabolical traditions of, like, 17th and 18th century Europe. What he did was just absolutely, like, it's absolutely stunning. One of the really great, you know, just really, really great horror book.
Yeah, what I really liked about the movie is that, to me, it really captured the essence of New Orleans and that whole area. I really felt like, I was there.
Yeah. The whole thing is just anything that's filmed in New Orleans is just such a cinematic city. I mean, I remember, like, Kathy and I, my wife and I first came there. It was November 2001. You know, we were still reeling. We had both just, like, you know, we had both 2 months earlier escaped Lower Manhattan in September 11th, so we're kind of dealing with, like, all kinds of post-traumatic stress disorder now looking back. You know, just coming, what a beautiful city it is, what a peaceful city it is, what a potentially violent city it is, but it's just like, you know, I remember New Orleans just being, like, a complete sensory overload. And that, you know, I mean, I think is still happening today. We have not been back since Katrina, I think, mainly because it's like, I'm just afraid of, like, you know, all these, like, here's the place I've been, oh, you know, here's the coffee shop we went to, remember this? And it's like, now it's this muddy, bombed out, like, shell, which is what a lot of the, like, New Orleans still is. I mean, that's like, you know, that right, Katrina is an American tragedy. It's like, it just showed everything that's been wrong with New Orleans for centuries. I mean, it just showed, like, it brought to light the fact that, like, the government of New Orleans has long treated, like, you know, has long seen its role as protecting the tourists who visit New Orleans from the people who live in New Orleans.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny that you got to put Indian heads anywhere to protect you from the law when, you know, the law were the biggest crooks.
Oh, New Orleans Police Department was like just... New Orleans Police Department has long been infamous as being like, you know, Philadelphia police look at you guys and look at New Orleans Police Department and say, my God, people, you got to clean this stuff up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, these Chicago police say you guys are brutal. It's like, you know, these guys are really... It's constantly been... New Orleans has... I mean, they had one... Sheriff, I'm trying to remember, I don't remember his name, but he said something like, you know, well, why don't, like, what do you think about, like, all the, like, you know, the crime rate in, like, the Ninth Ward among the blacks? He said, well, you don't have to worry. One of them boys gets killed, a bunch of his boys come out, and they kill the boy who killed him. Yeah, it's like, okay, so in other words, if some black guy gets shot, we don't really need to worry about the police too much, because, like, you know, his boys will shoot that boy. You know, putting aside the fact you're referring to these black people as boys, you know, the fact that, like, well, we don't have to worry about, like, you know, we don't have to worry about that crime because they take care of themselves. We're here to protect the tourists from them. I mean, that's like right. When you see the narrative that happened during Katrina, you know, the riot,
oh, you head up.
There were a
yeah,
lot more up. Black folks got shot by white cops than there were, like, black people shooting white folks. But the whole thing you heard was, like, you know, the savages looting and raping in the streets.
Well, if black people were... getting supplies, it was looting.
If white people were getting supplies, it was getting supplies.
Yeah, it was like doing something different. I mean, they had private security and cops and you know, they're guarding people's houses, you know, like rich people and stuff like that. And then they're just letting it go to hell.
Yeah, and it was, you know, one of the things with rebuilding New Orleans, they're like, well, should we rebuild some of these neighborhoods? It's sort of like, for decades, the powers that be in New Orleans have dreamed about, like, you know, a New Orleans that's free of the poor black folks.
Right.
It's kind of like, we can turn it into Disneyland. You know, we can make it, you know, if we get rid of those people, you know, what was it one, like, I'm trying to remember who it was, one fairly well-known talk radio host, I think, referred to them as savages. You know, if we get rid of the savages, if we get rid of the monkeys, you know, we get rid of the darkies, we're going to have a perfectly happy, safe, sane New Orleans. Like, and unfortunately, I mean, New Orleans without black, without the working class and poor black population, New Orleans culture without that is kind of like saying, you know, well, we're going to have, like, you know, Italian culture, but we're going to get rid of all the Italians.
Yeah, it's just completely ridiculous.
That's part of this. And it's like, you know, there's been this move to turn, like, New Orleans into, you know, a church. Like, since that time, you know, there's been very much a move to get rid of those people and make it, you know, a clean, safe place. And it's, you know, I think it's been just so blatant. Like, I mean, people, like, looking at all those, looking at the fact that, well, there had been, like, one of the things I discovered when I started doing the research was, if you, like, I'm trying to remember how I put this, is U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had said, well, you know, the levees of New Orleans are up to our standard. They looked at the standard they were holding them to. The levees of New Orleans were up to the standard you would expect for, like, a agricultural land along the Mississippi. In other words, the levees were pretty good for, like, if you're in Pig Tussle, North Dakota, and you got 30,000 acres of land with maybe 100, 200 people on those 30,000 acres.
Right.
They were in no way safe for a major urban area. That was a disaster waiting to happen for decades. I remember George Bush saying, you know, well, nobody knew there was going to be a hurricane. You know, it's like, well, how come in the New Orleans newspaper wrote a prophetic piece called, you can find it on the web, called When the Big One Hits, where they describe what's going to happen if the levees get breached. And pretty much describe exactly what happened with Katrina.
Because it already happened in, like, I think it was like the 20s.
It's that famous Led Zeppelin song from Memphis Men, you know, if it keeps on raining, live is gonna break.
Yeah.
That actually, when that levee broke, it spread a lot of, like, the poor black population, a lot of the sharecropper population. That was a large reason why the Delta Blues got spread all up and down, like, you know, the Midwest and into the cities. And, of course, after that spread from the Delta Blues, when it encountered, like, country music, it became rockabilly and then later rock and roll.
Right.
So, you know, I'm hoping that maybe 20 years from now we're going to see, you know, we're going to look back and be like, okay, you know, well, after this is what happened after Katrina. You know, maybe something wonderful is going to happen in Houston. Maybe something, you know, maybe there'll be something good be said about this whole, like, cluster screw. But it's like, yeah, we knew this was going to happen. The problem is like, nobody really ever did anything about it. And, you know, after it happened, everybody was a lot more interested in trying to blame everybody else for it than saying, you know, well, no. Well, we knew there were problems here. We knew that the levees weren't really up to snuff. We knew that that big new channel, Weed 7, for large shipping, the one that flooded a lot of coast, like, oyster beds, I think it was called the Mego Channel, that led to a storm surge going right into one of the levees that got knocked down. They knew about that. That thing should have been filled in decades ago again. Again, not years ago, decades ago. They've known for 20 years that thing was an accident waiting to happen.
Well, the whole city, the whole area is below sea level. I mean, it's like a hole.
Yes and no.
You know, so,
there is a part of New Orleans. New Orleans was built specifically because the original capital of the Louisiana Territory was Mobile, Alabama. They decided Mobile was too susceptible to hurricanes, so they moved to the high ground along the crescent of the Mississippi that's called, like, the Bucay, the old quarter. The French Quarter, if you look at the damage that was done to the French Quarter during Katrina, there was damage, there was flooding. Nothing near like what happened in the surrounding areas. The surrounding areas, as it grew out, the poorer areas tended to be below ground. The high ground was where there were wealthier stuff. The original city of New Orleans was actually wonderfully suited to hurricanes. Also, when the original city was built, we've lost a lot of the sandbars now thanks to erosion, you know, thanks to, like, basically the fact that we've fooled with the flow of the Mississippi. We don't have as much silting now. We don't have, you know, there are used miles of land that would suck up the storm surge from something like a Katrina. Miles of land that would break the hurricane. That's gone now. You know, and again, this isn't something like, you know, this isn't even hindsight. This is stuff people have been talking about for decades. Everybody's like, oh, God, you know, yeah, when a hurricane, real hurricane hits New Orleans, it's going to be awful. We knew it was going to happen, but nobody did anything about it. You know, when it happened, the main thing they did was make sure the savages didn't escape. They did very little to save people.
Well, they have.
Bush has blood on his hands. Well, he had blood on his hands before that, but that one, you know, there's no question.
Right. You have all the white people, all the rich people, whatever. They got all the primo land that's above, you know, the flood crest and all that. And, you know, black people could not get in there, so they all settled down below.
Yeah. That was pretty much most of those areas got very flooded.
Now, the people, most people won't do anything or they won't take action unless they are threatened, unless their money is threatened. And those people, you know, who are up on the ridges, you know, got the big houses and everything, they're not in danger of flooding. So why should they give a crap, you know, about the
living? Those neighborhoods have mostly been rebuilt. The wealthy neighborhoods, the ones that sustained less of the damage, unfortunately, one of the problems is, coming back at this point, because so many houses were damaged, the cost of living, you know, you had people who were living in the Ninth Ward, like, you know, maybe they were paying $200, $250 a month. It's like, okay, it's a rundown shotgun in kind of a high-crime neighborhood, but, you know, it's my damn rundown shotgun in my damn high-crime neighborhood. Now that high-crime neighborhood is a big old mud pit. And the closest thing they can find is running for like two, instead of $250, it's more like $1,250. And so, you know, people have been run out, like, there's very little affordable housing in New Orleans at this point. So, again, it's basically the poor people are moving out, like, you know, the poor people are, like, no longer able to stay there. You're no longer able to sustain that whole part of the culture. And it's like, I think that has more danger of really taking the heart and soul out of New Orleans than I think anything up to date has. I'll go that far. That, to me, is like, if anything is ever really going to take the heart and soul out of New Orleans, if it's going to turn it into like a Walt Disney World version of like The Princess and the Frog, where it's like a nice place for the tourists to go and listen to, like, you know, Dixieland jazz and like eat, you know, and eat Creole food, like, while not ever having to really engage with what that city was and what it meant, this is the danger. This here, you know, Katrina and our response, or our lack of response to it, may, like, you know, I don't know if it has killed New Orleans yet, but it came awful damn close.
Yeah, well, listen, you have thousands of houses in the same area that are not even habitable. There's so much mold and, well, especially now that all the animals and everything, you know, have moved in. I mean, there's no money to go and just clear all that out. And nobody's going to give them money, and because they don't want to build houses for people that are poor.
Yeah, I mean, it was very, you know, what was it, like Barbara Bush said, you know, well, I think these people have all done very well for themselves. They've gotten out of their ghetto, and now they've come to a nice, can get jobs and become real citizens. It's like, you know,
Yeah.
So putting aside, like, the sheer condescension and, like, you know, of that, you know, it's like the basic idea was, like, we're doing these people a favor. We're moving them out of the ghetto. It's like, and, like, maybe, it's like, Jack, maybe that place was a ghetto to you, and, yeah, maybe these people are poor, and, yeah, maybe the New Orleans school system sucks. It's one of the worst in the country. It's like, yeah, you know, maybe it was like a lot of crime here, but, you know, do you, like, instead of coming in and fixing this neighborhood, like, what these people are passionate about, this is a, there's a real culture here, instead of trying to fix that, you know, you're taking advantage of the flood to flush it away.
Oh, yeah.
And that's exactly, that's what's happened, and it's like, that to me is like, that's going to do, like, that has done some real, real damage to New Orleans. I mean, New Orleans is still in the process of reinventing itself. So, you know, it may come through. I mean, but, like, New Orleans has survived a lot of stuff.
Oh,
but
it'll
this
be fine.
One, you know, it's really, like, it really hit at the heart of New Orleans. I think, you know, in a way that a lot of people don't understand, it's like, you know, it's taken away a lot of, you know, it's taken away the soul of that city. It's taken away, you know, this is the culture where the voodoo comes from. This is the culture where a lot of the food comes from. You know, this is a culture where, like, that whole mindset comes from. And it's gone, you know, and what you're replacing it with is, like, a bunch of people who are, you know, a bunch of people who are coming to New Orleans because it's, like, this kind of hedonistic fun time place, which it is. But it's like, it's more than that, and it's like, I'm just so afraid we're going to lose that.
Yep. Yep. So, I got someone in the room that is saying we're full of crap. The poor are living like kings on the government dollar. You have no idea what you're talking about. Aren't you in New York? What the fuck do you know about what goes on here?
Ah, I can use the F word here. I got to think. What do I know? Like, the poor are living like kings on the government dollar. Like,
yes.
Us, like, you know, if they're living like kings, it's like, I remember somebody describing, like, a restaurant in New Orleans once as saying, like, you could get a meal fit for a king, like, if you're the king of a small country, like, whose subjects have cruelly thrown you out and forced you to now live on your voices. It's kind of like, what exactly king do you think is living in a FEMA trailer?
You know, well, yeah, now they're kicking them out.
What kind of kings do you think are living, you know, basically, the Ninth Ward may be many things, but Home of Kings, I think not. You know, there's, I also, like, is the person who's saying this, is he from the city of New Orleans? I'm going to take a guess. It'll be Gretna, possibly Metairie, possibly Kenner, probably one of the white suburbs. That definitely, like, I'm guaranteeing you. That is basically, that's not somebody who's in the city right now. I'll be real surprised if it is.
They definitely don't live in the in the ghetto.
No, I mean, it's like...
Or probably see that area.
Yeah, I mean, and the part is that you'll also see that attitude. You know, those people are living like kings. You know, they are living like... You know, they're just living off the welfare. And, like, what really scared them in New Orleans is they can't live off the government teat no more. We kind of flushed them out. You know, that's become a recurring narrative with a lot of people who talk about New Orleans. It's kind of like, you know, well, why'd all those people die in the floods? Because they were too lazy to get out. You want to know why a lot of people died in Katrina? Because it happened on August 29th, and it was a couple days before the welfare checks came in, so they didn't have the money to get the bus to get out.
Yeah.
And the city of New Orleans did very little to nothing to actually help those people. You know, well, you got to get out. Well, I don't have money. Well, that's your problem. You know, it's like, there was like that, like, the number of deaths there were in, like, Katrina, you could have had, like, so many of those deaths were preventable. So many, you know, it's like, there was so, like, we could have, like, there, it's just, again, that story is just, that is a true, that is an, like, the way that was handled is an American tragedy of our times. You know, it was a, I'd say it was a comedy of errors, but when 1,000 people, like, over 1,000 people died, they're just, I find it hard to be real amused.
Well, they have no, they really didn't have any disaster recovery plan at all. I mean, they knew something like this was very, could very well happen. You know, if they got hit with the category 4 or 5 hurricane, that the lights were not going to survive.
But then it was, you like, know? We knew it was like the 5. It's like, we knew, like, category 5, cat 4, cat 3, we've known that for years, you know, that, like, that was any big hurricane. I mean, heck, the rain they're getting right now is probably going to cause a pretty good bit of damage. Having just gone through Irene, people underestimate, like, how bad a heavy rain can do you a lot more damage than a heavy wind.
Right.
I'm, like, kind of watching that right now. I'm hoping that I'm hoping things stay okay there, but it's like, and I'm also hoping that this season we don't get another hit on New Orleans. Because it's like, my friend, someday we're going to have another Katrina. And you want to know what? The levees ain't no more ready for the next one than they were the last time.
No, probably even worse. Hey, the person was from Metairie?
Metairie.
Yeah,
that's what I thought. Yep. Another, like, you know, fairly wealthy white suburb where, like, the basic, like, everybody in New Orleans, like, the people of New Orleans are essentially, like, there's the rich people, like, the natives of New Orleans are, like, I believe it was Don Imus used to call, it was the Grease Man who used to call, like, the black people of New Orleans, of Washington, D.C., the IPs, the indigenous population. That's kind of like, you know, well, and of course, the poor people in New Orleans are living like kings. Yeah, they collect welfare all the time, they drive around in Cadillacs, you know, they basically, oh, you know, they support themselves with food stamps, that's why they have 15 and 16 kids. You know, it's a very common, you know, narrative. You hear it all the time, and it really does not have a lot of bearing on reality. I mean, anybody that's ever walked through the Ninth Ward, for God's sake, these people aren't living like kings. They're living in poverty.
And not to mention our economy is like 10 feet away from another, like, a double-dip recession, apocalypse, Mad Max. So it's not like jobs are just being thrown out on the assembly line. I mean, our economy is crap right now.
It's the entire world is going through, like, a death throes. It's like a over time, it's going to take, but you'll see everything start to reinvent itself. So it's not going to get over quickly. It may not get over for 10, 15 years. You know, and every single country in the world is going through it too.
Yeah.
We have a few minutes left. What is a root doctor?
A root doctor is, you'll also, that within hoodoo, you'll hear root doctor. You'll also hear conjure man or conjure woman. You'll hear a two-headed man or two-headed woman. It's generally somebody who works with hoodoo. You know, somebody who's known to have spiritual power. I've heard them called, like, intercessors. Somebody who's not, like, basically a root doctor is somebody who knows, like, a number of tricks, or, like, what they call wanga in voodoo, you know, knows a number of things and has a connection with the spirits, and basically somebody who, like, God answers their prayers.
The root doctor. Gotcha. Just curious exactly what that meant. So how does music play in all this? Music is a big part of voodoo in New Orleans, of course. Before the show, I was listening to some voodoo drums. I have some CDs that I downloaded of just voodoo drums from Haiti.
There's some great stuff. Well, you've got several different strains of music that have actually started, you know, within New Orleans. I mean, one of the big ones, of course, is after the Spanish-American War, at the end of the 20th century, near the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, the military bands were decommissioned, and, like, after they were coming out of Cuba, the place, like, there's always been a lot of trade between Cuba and New Orleans, so what they did is, like, basically New Orleans was awash in cheap brass instruments. A lot of people who before this had not really had access to, like, trumpets, trombones, tubas, etc., got their hands on them, and they started learning to play them. They had some rather non-standard fingering styles. Sometimes, you know, they were doing some wah-wahs that you wouldn't really hear, using kind of vibrato that you might not hear from a classically trained person. But they came up with this kind of sound that was sort of like jazzy. And so it became New Orleans jazz, which is jazz really, like, jazz started in New Orleans, the blues, like, started, that one's a fascinating topic, which started in the Delta. Delta blues, man, is almost direct. Like, no, it's not even almost. It is a direct survival of a group of people you will find in Mali called Les Griots, the Griots. They go around, they tend to sing songs, like the Griots sing these songs, they use a pentatonic scale, which has flat notes on the third and the fifth. The songs tend to be a lot of times about their sexual, they tend to be about cheating women, about like hard times, going to jail, sometimes getting right with Allah. You know, it's basically, it is blues. Blues comes, you can trace blues right to Mali, to a tradition which is alive today. You know, you can trace it in the style of the music, you can trace it in the, like, in the content of the lyrics, you can trace it in the role the griot is held in. Griots are kind of seen as, like, a lot of times having almost a supernatural power, but they're kind of known for their loose living. You don't, like, you know, they're known for being kind of womanizing, drinking, and, you know, going to jail a lot. You know, in other words, blues. That one in New Orleans, let's see, you know, New Orleans music, New Orleans at one time was a huge opera center. That was, that is great opera town. It's, New Orleans has always had a great entertainment community. It's always been a tourist town.
Got those blues, baby, those voodoo blues.
The voodoo blues. New Orleans is like, yeah, that's basically, yeah, we wouldn't have had rock and roll if it weren't for the blues, and we might not have had the, like, you know, we, blues and jazz, I mean, jazz, American classical music starts in New Orleans. That's the best way to put it. I mean, jazz is America's classical music, and it, you know, has its roots in the Crescent City.
So, T-Naz, what's your next book plan?
Right now, I'm just promoting the New Orleans Voodoo book. I've got several things I'm working on. I want to follow up on my history, Power of the Poppy, where I did the history of poppies. You know, I'm working on a book which is the, you know, it's called Speed 5000. Right now, working title is Speed 5000 Years of Life in the Fast Lane, and it's going to describe, you know, our efforts ourselves, beginning with caffeine and ending with, like, the methamphetamine and the bike gangs of San Diego.
Cool.
With a stop along the way for bath salts. It's like pretty much everything, like any stimulant that's ever been, like, I just want to do a history of stimulants because we've been trying to wake up for 5,000 years.
Hey, you know that person in the comment room was Miss Jojo.
Miss Jojo.
What was it?
It's Joe's wife telling us we're full of crap, calling us names. What's up with that?
Which
thing?
Who's Joe?
Joe's our producer. He owns the network.
That's not well. No, I mean, it does not surprise me. There, like, that particular narrative that, like, you know, the people in New Orleans made out like bandits on there, you know, that they never did anything but, like, you know, sit down and collect welfare all the time, and now, you know, we've just created this whole under, you know, this privileged underclass. I mean, Ronald Reagan was telling stories about welfare queens in the 80s. You hear the same stories today, and they're no more true then than they were now. You know, I mean, it's kind of like people, how many, like, I don't know how many people you, how many single mothers you ever met on welfare. Believe me, there are easier ways to get food than popping out babies.
Let me tell you something. 50, and they're going on and on and on about this right now. All the Republicans, all these people saying, oh, all these people are getting a free ride. You know, you're saying tax the rich, but, you know, 50% of the population in the United States does not pay income tax. And that's true because they make under $24,000 a year, okay? And it only makes up
50% of the United States is poor.
Right. It only makes up 2.5% of our entire, you know, the money in the country. That's it. 50% of the people have 2.5% of the wealth.
Yeah, that's,
okay?
I mean,
that taxing them is not going to give you any money. It's not going to fix anything, you know?
It's like, we have an enormous income disparity in this country. You know, it's like, and I think what's, the one thing which I could see with New Orleans is the essential model where you have a privileged class and the police essentially exist to protect the privileged class from the less privileged class. that may well be the model for American society in the 21st century. I mean, it's like in New Orleans, they've always been relatively blatant about that. I mean, it's never really been, there's never really been that much attempt to hide the fact that, you know, in New Orleans, we have utter contempt for our poor, and if they get out of hand, we'll send them to Angola prison. But I think they're moving into that model where it's like, you know, where it's like, we let them get away with that in New Orleans because it's only New Orleans, and it's like, well, now it's coming to our, now it's coming to our shores.
Right. Hey, guys, we got about 30 seconds, so let's go up ahead and wrap things up.
Want to say that our government's so corrupt, if you can get any pennies out of them, bleed them dry. All they want to do is kill people with their war machines and death machines. Kenaz, what's your link again before we go?
KENAZFILAN.blogspot.com. And I'm KenazFilan.com. You can also find, I've got a website with a link to my blog and some of my writing.
Well, definitely appreciate it. It's been a great show, and we'll have to get you back sometime. It's been great learning about voodoo hoodoo, baby. That's right.
Having a lot of fun. Looking forward to it. Hope everybody had a good time listening. Even you, Ms. JoJo. You have a good day there. Oh, nothing makes me happier than having somebody tell me I'm full of crap. You know you're doing something right when you tick somebody off, so.
He's gonna go make a voodoo doll of you now.
She's gonna be yelling at JoJo. You get them guys off our network. How dare they?
Good night, everybody.
All right, goodbye, everybody.